If I happened to be walking along Bull Street in the late afternoon, I would invariably see a very old and very dignified black man. He always wore a suit and tie, a starched white shirt, and a fedora. His ties were muted paisleys and regimental stripes, and his suits were fine and well-tailored, though apparently made for a slightly larger person. Every day at the same time, the old man walked through the cast-iron gates of the grandiose Armstrong House at the north end of Forsyth Park. He turned left and proceeded up Bull Street all the way to City Hall and back. He was very much a gentleman. He tipped his hat and bowed in greeting. But I noticed that he and the people he spoke with, usually well-dressed businessmen, played a very odd game. The men would ask him, "Still walking the dog?" It was perfectly clear that the old man was not walking a dog, but he would respond by saying, "Oh, yes, still walking the dog." Then he would look over his shoulder and say to the air behind him, "Come on, Patrick." And off he'd go. One day, as I came through Madison Square, I saw him standing by the monument facing a semicircle of tourists. He was singing. I couldn't make out the words, but I could hear his reedy tenor voice. The tourists applauded when he was done, and one of the lady tour guides slipped something into his hand. He bowed and left them. We approached the crosswalk at the same time. "That was very nice," I said.
"Why, thank you kindly," he replied in his courtly way. "My name is William Simon Glover."
I introduced myself and told Mr. Glover that it seemed we often took the same walk at the same hour. I said nothing about the dog, figuring that the subject would come up on its own.
"Oh, yes," he said. "I'm 86 years old, and I'm downtown at 7 o'clock every morning. I'm retired, but I don't stay still. I work as a porter for the law firm of Bowen, Williams, and Levy."
Mr. Glover's voice had a bounce to it. He pronounced the name of the law firm as if an exclamation point followed each of the partners' names.
"I'm a porter, but everybody knows me as a singer," he said as we started to cross the street. "I learned to sing in church when I was 12. I pumped the organ for a quarter while one lady played and another lady sang. I didn't know nothing about no German, French, or Italian, but by me hearing the lady sing so much, I learned to say the words whether I knew what they was or not. One Sunday morning, the lady didn't sing, so I sang instead. And I sang in Italian. I sang Hallelujah."
"How did it go?" I asked him. Mr. Glover stopped and faced me. He opened his mouth wide and drew a deep breath. From the back of his throat came a high, croaking sound.
"Alleluia, alleluia."
He had abandoned his tenor and was singing in a wavering falsetto. Forever in his mind, apparently, Alleluia would be a soprano piece as sung by the lady in church so many years before.
"Alleluia, Alleluia, 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 Alleluia."
Mr. Glover stopped for a breath.
"And then the lady always finished by saying,
Alleluia."
"So that was your debut," I said.
"That's right. That's how I started. That lady learned me to sing in German, French, and Italian. Oh, yes. And I've been musical director of the First African Baptist Church since 1916. I directed a chorus of 500 voices for Franklin D. Roosevelt when he visited Savannah on November 18, 1933. I remember the date because that was the very day my daughter was born. I named her Eleanor Roosevelt Glover. I can remember the song we sang, too, Come By Here. The doctor sent word up to me, 'Tell Glover he can sing Come By Here for the President all he damn pleases, but I just come by his house and left a baby girl, and I want him to come by my office and pay me $15.
When we parted at the corner of Oglethorpe Avenue, I realized that I was still in the dark about the imaginary dog, Patrick. A week or so later, when I next fell in step with Mr. Glover, I made a mental note to bring the subject around to it. But Mr. Glover had other things to talk about first.
"You know about psychology," he said. "You learn that in school. You learn people-ology on the Pullman. I was a porter for the Pullman during the war. You had to keep the passengers well satisfied for them to tip you 50 cents or a dollar. You say, 'Wait a minute, sir. You going up to the club car? Your tie is crooked.' Now, his tie is really straight as an arrow, but you pull it crooked, and then you pull it straight again, and he likes it. That's people-ology. Keep a whisk broom in your pocket and brush him off. He don't need no brushing off, but he don't know it. Brush him off anyhow. And straighten his collar. Pull it crooked and straighten it again. Miss Mamie don't need a box for her hat, but you be sure and put her hat in a box. If you sit and don't do nothing, you won't get nothing. Another thing I learned, don't ever ask a man, 'How is Mrs. Brown?' You ask him, 'How is Miss Julia? Tell her I ask about her.' I never did ask Mr. Boone about Mrs. Boone. I ask him, 'How is Miss Helen? Tell Miss Helen I ask about her.' He liked it, and she liked it. Mr. Boone gave me his old clothes and shoes. Miss Helen gave me records from her collection, all kinds of records. I got records I don't even know I got. I even got records of that great opera singer, Henry Cocoruso." "I keep busy," Mr. Glover said. "I don't sit down and hold my hand. I got $500 of life insurance, and it's all paid up. I paid 25 cents a week for 70 years, and last week the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company sent me a check for $1,000.
Mr. Glover's eyes were sparkling.
"No, sir, I don't sit down and hold my hand."
"Glover!"
came a booming voice from behind us. A tall, white-haired man in a gray suit approached. "Still walking the dog?"
"Why, yes, sir, yes, I am."
Mr. Glover did his little bow and tipped his hat and gestured to the invisible dog behind him.
"I'm still walking Patrick."
"Glad to hear it, Glover. Keep it up. Take care now."
With that, the man walked away. "How long have you been walking Patrick?" I asked. Mr. Glover straightened up.
"Oh, for a long time. Patrick was Mr. Boone's dog. Mr. Boone used to give him Chivas Regal Scotch liquor to drink. I walked the dog, and I was the dog's bartender, too. Mr. Boone said that after he died, I was to be paid $10 a week to take care of Patrick. He put that in his will. I had to walk him and buy his Scotch liquor. When Patrick died, I went to see Judge Lawrence. The judge was Mr. Boone's executor. I said, 'Judge, you can stop paying me the $10 now because Patrick is dead.' And Judge Lawrence said, 'What do you mean Patrick is dead? How could he be? I see him right there on the carpet.' Well, I looked behind me, and I didn't see no dog. But then I thought a minute, and I said, 'Oh, I think I see him too, Judge.' And the judge said, 'Good. So you just keep walking him, and we'll keep paying you. The dog is dead 20 years now, but I still walk him. I walk up and down Bull Street and look over my shoulder and say, "Come on, Patrick."'"
As for the mysterious old lady who punched out Joe Odom's windows with a hammer, I never saw her again. I did learn, however, that there were quite a few people in Savannah who might have felt justified in smashing Joe's windows as a result of having done business with him. The ranks of such people included any number of old ladies. At least half a dozen people, for instance, had come to grief in Joe's most recent real estate development deal, the conversion of an office building into a luxurious apartment house, the Lafayette. Shortly before completing the renovation, Joe hosted a gala dinner dance in the building as a preview for prospective buyers. 16 of the guests signed up for apartments then and there, and 6 plunked down cash. The new owners were just about to move into the building when events took an unexpected turn. A mortgage company swooped down and repossessed their apartments. How could this happen? The people had paid for their apartments in full. The answer wasn't long in coming. Joe had defaulted on his construction loan and had never bothered to transfer the deeds to the new owners. At the moment of foreclosure, The apartments were still in his name, so they were seized as collateral. The rightful owners were forced to go to court to retrieve their apartments. Joe never lost his good humor throughout the affair. Like an unflappable master of ceremonies, he cheerfully reassured his clients that things would sort themselves out. Whether they believed him or not, most chose to forgive him. One woman communed with the Lord, who told her not to sue. Another simply refused to believe that so lovely a young man could have done anything improper. "I suppose I should hate him," said an osteopath, who had lost money in another of Joe's financial schemes. "But he's too damn likable." There were rumors that Joe had squandered the money from the construction loan for the Lafayette, that he had chartered a private plane and taken a dozen friends to New Orleans to select a chandelier for the lobby and, incidentally, attend the Sugar Bowl game. After the foreclosure, however, it was clear that Joe had in no way enriched himself in the fiasco. In fact, he had lost his car, his boat, his butler, his wife, and title to his house. In the aftermath of the Lafayette affair, Joe had found it necessary to supplement his income by playing piano at private parties and by opening his house to busloads of tourists several days a week at $3 a head as part of a tour package that included lunch in a historic townhouse. The tour companies would send caterers to Joe's house at 11:45 a.m. with platters and tureens of food. The tour buses would pull up at noon. The tourists would walk through the house, eat a buffet lunch, and listen to Joe play a few songs on the piano. Then, at 12:45, the tourists would get back on the bus, and the caterers would pack up and leave. Laughter and music continued to ring through 16 East Jones Street day and night, as it had before, but Joe was merely a rent-paying tenant now. Neither the house nor anything in it belonged to him anymore. Not the portraits, not the carpets, not the silver. Not even the little panes of glass upon which the mysterious old lady, whoever she was, had taken out her fury. Chapter 5. The Inventor. The voice came over my shoulder like a murmuring breeze. "Oh, don't do that," it said. "Whatever you do, don't do that." I was standing at the sales counter in Clary's drugstore after breakfast one morning, and when I turned around, I was confronted by a scarecrow of a man. He had a long neck and a protruding Adam's apple. Lank brown hair hung over his forehead. The man's face reddened, as if he'd been caught thinking out loud. It struck me that if either of us should have been embarrassed, I was the one. I had just asked the salesgirl what I should do about the crystallized ring of black scum that would not come off my toilet bowl. The girl had told me to use steel wool. The man smiled self-consciously. "Steel wool leaves big scratches in the porcelain," he said. "Those are calcium deposits you've got. It's from the water. You need to scrub them off with a red brick. A brick's harder than the calcium deposits, but it's not as hard as the porcelain, and it won't scratch it." I had seen this man several times before, right here in Clary's drugstore. He was one of the regulars who came in for breakfast every morning. Although we had never spoken before, I knew who he was. That was one of the things about Clary's drugstore. It was a clearinghouse of information, a burst of gossip. Despite the permanent smell of burned bacon grease and the likelihood that Ruth or Lily would get the orders confused, Clary's had a loyal breakfast and lunch clientele. People sauntered in, sidled in, or stumbled in, and their condition was duly noted over the tops of newspapers. Customers greeted one another from table to table, or from table to soda fountain, and every word was overheard, and passed along later. Patrons at any given moment might include a housewife, a real estate broker, a lawyer, an art student, and perhaps a pair of carpenters doing work in a townhouse down the street. One of the carpenters might be heard to say, "All we got to do today is seal up that doorway between her bedroom and his," and the news that a marital ice age had descended on the townhouse in question would be common coin by the end of the day. Overheard remarks were as much a commodity at Clary's drugstore as Goody's powder or Chigarid. The man who told me to scrub my toilet bowl with a brick performed a peculiar daily ritual at Clary's. He always ordered the same breakfast. Eggs, bacon, a Bayer aspirin, and a glass of spirits of ammonia and Coca-Cola. But he didn't always consume it. Sometimes he just looked at it. He'd put both hands flat on the table as if to steady his gaze, and he'd stare at his plate. Then he would either begin to eat, or get up without a word and walk out the door. The next day, Ruth would serve him the same breakfast and go back to her perch at the end of the soda fountain to take a drag on her cigarette and see what he'd do. I, too, began to watch. Whenever he left without touching his food, Ruth would say to no one in particular, "Luther's not eating." She'd clear his plate away and put his bill beside the cash register. From the remarks that followed these exits, I learned that the man's name was Luther Driggers, and that some years back he had achieved a certain prominence in Savannah. He had made a discovery involving a certain pesticide and its ability to pass through plastic that had led to the invention of the flea collar and the no-pest strip. In this respect, it could be said that Luther Driggers was the modern equivalent of Savannah's other famous inventor, Eli Whitney. As it happened, neither man made a dime from his invention. Eli Whitney had carefully kept the cotton gin under wraps while he applied for a patent, but he made a tactical error when he allowed women to have a look at it, assuming that they wouldn't understand what they were looking at. A male entrepreneur put on a dress one day and slipped in with a group of women visitors, then went home and made his own cotton gin. Luther Driggers' case was complicated by his having been a government employee at the time he had made his discovery. Government employees had no monetary claim to their work. The only way Driggers could have profited was by selling the pertinent information to a private manufacturer. While he wrestled with the moral pros and cons of doing just that, one of his colleagues beat him to it. Luther Driggers had a mournful expression, but his failure to make any money from the flea collar was not the only reason for it. His life seemed to be marked by a succession of unfortunate misadventures. His early marriage to his high school sweetheart had lasted little more than a year. Her father was the owner of a supermarket, and the girl's dowry consisted of a house and unlimited free groceries. When the marriage came to an end, the house and the groceries went with it. Luther moved into an old mortuary at the corner of Jones and Bull, where the first thing he did was to convert the tiled embalming room into a shower. Later, he sold some inherited property and bought an old townhouse. He leased the house to tenants and converted the carriage house behind it into living quarters for himself. In the process of renovation, he devoted considerable attention to one small design detail of the stairway, the so-called false step. The riser of the false step was 1 inch higher than the other steps, so that it would trip up anybody unfamiliar with it and serve as a primitive burglar alarm. This was a device used in many old houses, but it proved to be a hazard for Driggers, since he generally arrived home in no shape to deal with normal stairs, let alone trick ones. Furthermore, once the stairs were built, he realized he'd overlooked an important consideration, namely where to put the stairway in the first place. He'd put it against the one wall that could have had windows and a view of the garden. As a result, the living room looked out onto a back alley and a big brown dumpster. It was while nursing a bruised shin suffered from a fall over the false step that Luther went one afternoon to the Wright Square post office to check the weight of a pound of marijuana he was about to buy. He wanted to make sure he wasn't being cheated. To his amazement, he was stopped at the door, his package seized, and he was arrested. As the Savannah Evening Press explained in its coverage of the event, the post office had received a bomb threat only minutes before. The story said Luther's parcel contained slightly less than a pound of marijuana. Luther would have been shortchanged, just as he'd feared. Luther's misfortunes pained his friends, particularly the headstrong Serena Dawes. Luther and Serena were an unlikely pair. Serena was much older than Luther, and she spent most of her waking hours lounging in her four-poster bed, propped up against an embankment of tiny pillows. From her silken dais, Serena would cajole Luther to fix her a drink, look for her stockings, answer the door, get some ice, hand her a comb, fluff up her pillows, massage her ankles. Alternately, and without a hint of irony, she would exhort him to stand up for his rights. "A lady," she would say in her most languid, multisyllabic drawl, "expects a gentleman to take what belongs to him." Whenever Serena took this line, she was usually thinking about the proceeds from the flea collar and the no-pest strip. Serena had calculated what baubles these proceeds could have bought. Serena Vaughan Dawes had been a celebrated beauty in her day. She was so alluring that Cecil Beaton had called her one of the most perfect natural beauties I've ever photographed. The daughter of a socially prominent lawyer from Atlanta, Serena had met the young Simon T. Dawes of Pittsburgh, grandson of a steel tycoon, while on a vacation in Newport before the Second World War. Simon Dawes was smitten by Serena. Gossip columnists across the country breathlessly chronicled their whirlwind romance. But when the New York Daily News reported that the couple had become engaged, Dawes' mother, the formidable Theodora Cabot Dawes, telegraphed a haughty one-word comment that was blown up into headlines. "Son engaged? Absurd," says Mrs. Dawes. Mrs. Dawes's opposition to the engagement was rendered moot by the subsequent elopement of Simon and Serena. After their honeymoon at the old DeSoto Hotel in Savannah, the newlyweds went back to live in Pittsburgh. As Mrs. Simon T. Dawes, Serena became an icon of upper-crust glamour in the 1930s and 1940s. Her photograph adorned full-page cigarette ads in Life magazine. The copy always carried a message to the effect that Mrs. Simon T. Dawes of Pittsburgh was a lady of refined taste, that she traveled first class and resided in presidential suites wherever she went. In the ads, Serena would be sitting in quiet splendor, her head tilted back, and a wisp of smoke rising from the cigarette held in her fair hand. Beneath the serenity, however, there was fire, and Serena's mother-in-law knew it. The elder Mrs. Dawes did her best to bend Serena to her will. She admonished Serena to donate the fees from her endorsements to charity, and Serena did. But when Serena discovered that her mother-in-law secretly pocketed her own fees from such endorsements, she slapped the woman's face and called her a heathen bitch. The two women loathed each other. When Simon Dawes accidentally shot himself in the head and died, his mother took her revenge on Serena. The family affairs had been arranged so that the bulk of Simon's estate would circumvent Serena and go to their children. But Serena would not be outdone. She announced her intention to sell her mansion in Pittsburgh to a black family. A group of rich neighbors begged her to let them buy it first. She sold it to them for a king's ransom and moved to Savannah. It was in Savannah that Serena plunged headlong into middle age. She gained weight, indulged herself endlessly, and became the soul of pampered self-absorption. She spent most of her day in bed, holding court, drinking martinis and pink ladies, and playing with her white toy poodle, Lulu. As much as Serena detested her former in-laws, she reveled in her connection to them. She never tired of telling people that the bed she lay in had once belonged to Algernon Dawes, the steel millionaire. Photographs of Dawes's and Cabot's stood sentry on the night table. A full-length portrait of her hated mother-in-law hung in the dining room, just as her own Cecil Beaton photographs adorned the walls of her bedroom. Serena thrived in this museum of her former self. She had a wardrobe that consisted mostly of shorty nightgowns and peignoirs. They revealed her still shapely legs and discreetly swathed her upper half in clouds of feathers and silk chiffon. She dyed her hair flaming red and painted her fingernails and toenails dark green. She bullied and wheedled. She railed and purred. She drawled and cussed and carried on. For emphasis, she threw objects across the room. Pillows, drinks, even Lulu the poodle. Every now and then she would sweep the Dawses and Cabots off the night table with an oath and send them crashing to the floor. Serena didn't choose to mingle in Savannah's society, nor was she invited to do so. But Savannah's elite never tired of talking about her. "She has no couples as callers," said a woman who lived a few houses down Gordon Street. "Only young men. You never see ladies going into her house at all. She is not, as far as I know, a member of any garden club. She's not neighborly." But after a fashion, Serena loved Luther, and Luther loved Serena. The unassuming, shy, and hapless Luther Driggers had a darker side. He was possessed by inner demons who showed themselves in disturbing ways. Chronic insomnia was one of them. Luther had once gone 9 days without falling asleep. Sleep, when it came, was rarely peaceful. Luther usually slept with his teeth and his fists tightly clenched. By morning, he would awake with sore jaws and little crescent-shaped cuts in his palms. People worried about Luther's demons, but they were not so much concerned with the uneaten breakfast, or the lost sleep, or the bleeding palms. They were fearful about something much more serious. It was rumored that Luther had in his possession a bottle of poison 500 times more deadly than arsenic, a poison so lethal that if he ever dumped it into the city's water supply, it would kill every man, woman, and child in Savannah. Years back, a delegation of nervous citizens had informed the police, and the police had searched Luther's house without finding anything. That satisfied no one, of course, and the rumors persisted. Luther certainly knew all about poisons, and how to use them. He was a technician at the government insectary on the outskirts of Savannah. His job required that he sift through jugs of barn sweepings, sort out the weevils and beetles, and raise them in colonies so that he could test various insecticides on them. The difficult part of the job was the requirement that Luther inject insecticide into the chest cavities of the individual insects. This operation demanded the dexterity of a watchmaker. It was hard enough to do sober. With a hangover and tremors, it was nearly impossible. "God, it's tedious work," Luther said. Sometimes, to relieve the boredom, Luther anesthetized ordinary houseflies and glued lengths of thread to their backs. When the flies awoke, they flew around, trailing the threads behind them. "It makes them easier to catch," he said. On occasion, Luther walked through downtown Savannah, holding a dozen or more threads in his hand, each a different color. Some people walked dogs. Luther walked flies. Now and then, when he visited friends, he took a few of the flies with him and let them loose in the living room. At other times, Luther pasted the wings of a wasp on top of a fly's own wings to improve its aerodynamics. Or he made one wing slightly shorter than the other so it'd fly in circles for the rest of its life. It was just this side of Luther, his quirky tinkering, that left people with a lingering uneasiness about whether he might one day pour his bottle of poison into Savannah's water supply. They worried about this most of all when his well-known demons got the better of him. And whenever Luther walked out of Clary's without eating breakfast, which he had been doing of late, it was a sign that his demons were stirring. This concern was uppermost in my mind, in fact, when Luther was explaining why I should scrub my toilet bowl with a brick. He was telling me about, of all things, Savannah's water supply. Savannah's water came from a limestone aquifer, he said. It was rich in calcium bicarbonate, which loses a molecule and turns into crystals of calcium carbonate when it dries. "Hey, listen," I wanted to say, "what's this I hear about you and a deadly poison?" But I didn't. I just thanked him for the advice. The next morning, when he sat down at the table next to me, I leaned over and gave him the news. "The brick worked," I said. "Thanks."
"Good," he said. "You could have used a pumice stone instead. That would have done just as well as a brick."
Ruth put Luther's breakfast in front of him, and as usual, he began to stare at it. I noticed a bright green thread tied to the buttonhole of his lapel. It hung loosely down the front of his jacket. As Luther stared at his eggs, the green thread became taut. Then it swung counterclockwise and came to rest along his left shoulder. It stayed there for a moment, then lifted into the air as if caught in an updraft. It hung aloft, still anchored to his lapel, then floated down and lay across his chest. Luther was oblivious to the movements of the thread and to the antics of the fly at the end of it. He saw that I was watching him.
"I don't know," he said with a sigh. "Sometimes I just can't face going through with breakfast."
"I've noticed," I said. Luther blushed at the thought that his eating habits had been observed, and he started to eat.
"I have a deficiency of stomach acid," he said. "It's not serious. It's called hypochlorhydria. I'm told Rasputin had the same condition, but I wouldn't know about that. All I know is that at times of stress, my gastric juices just quit on me, and I can't digest food. But it passes."
"About these gastric juices," I said, "have you been under a lot of tension lately?"
"Well, sort of," Luther said. "I'm working on something new. It's something that could make a lot of money, if it works. The problem is, I haven't got it to work yet."
Luther paused for a moment, considering whether to let me into his confidence. "Do you know what black lights are?" he asked. "Those purple fluorescent lights that make things glow in the dark? Well, you know, a lot of bars have fish tanks illuminated with black lights. The purple tree down on Johnson Square does. I got to thinking what a shame it was that goldfish didn't glow in the dark. So I'm trying to find a way to make them glow. If they did glow, they'd look as if they were floating in air like giant fireflies, just the kind of weird vision a guy getting drunk at a bar could spend hours looking at. I know I would. Every bar in America would have to have them. That's why I want to find a way to make them glow." "Do you think you can?"
"I'm experimenting with fluorescent dye," he said. "The first thing I did was dip the goldfish directly into the dye, and it killed them. Then I took a slower approach and poured a teaspoon of dye into the fish tank and waited. After a week, a faint glow appeared on the gills and on the tips of the fins, but it wasn't enough to make much of an impact in a bar. Little by little, I poured more dye into the water, but the fish didn't glow any brighter, and the glow didn't spread to any other parts of the fish. All that happened was the pH factor of the water increased, and in a couple of days the fish were dead. That's where I'm at right now."
The fly had alighted on Luther's eyebrow. The green thread dangled down his cheek as if it were attached to a monocle. Drigger's Golden Glowfish. Sure, why not? Fortunes had been built on less. "I like it," I said. "I hope you can make it happen."
"I'll let you know," said Luther.
Our conversations over the next few days were brief. Several times Luther just waved and gave me the thumbs-up sign. On one occasion, I thought I saw a small horsefly hovering over him. I couldn't tell whether it was attached by a thread, but it followed him up to the cash register, and when he left the premises, he appeared to hold the door open for it. One morning, when I came into Clary's, he waved me over.
"I'm trying a new approach," he said. "I'm mixing the fluorescent dye with fish food, and I'm beginning to see results. The gills and the fin tips are glowing pretty good, and there's even some fluorescent in the eyes and around the mouth."
Luther told me he planned to go to the Purple Tree later that evening for the first public tryout. I was welcome to join him if I liked. I could meet him at the home of Serena Dawes at 10 o'clock, and the three of us would proceed to the Purple Tree together. At 10 o'clock sharp, Serena Dawes's maid, Maggie, came to the door of her townhouse. She showed me into a front parlor, which was furnished in the grand manner. French Empire furniture, heavy swag curtains, and plenty of gold leaf. Then she disappeared to the rear of the house to attend her mistress. Judging from the sounds coming from that direction, Serena's appearance would be some time off. I could hear the high-pitched strains of a one-way conversation.
"Put it back! Put it back!" she screeched. "It doesn't match, goddammit, now hand me the other one." "No, damn it, that one. I can't wear these shoes. Maggie, you're hurting me. Well, be more careful next time and listen to what I say. Did you call the police like I told you to? Did they catch those nasty little redneck bastards? Did they? They ought to shoot 'em. Kill 'em. They nearly blew the goddamn house down. Luther, darling, hold the mirror higher so I can see. That's better. Lulu, come to Mama. Come to Mama, Lulu. Ooh, Mama's little love. Mama's little kissy-woo. Maggie, do something to my drink. Well, can't you see the ice is melted?
At 11 o'clock, I looked up to see a pair of pale and shapely legs supporting a tumult of pink marabou surmounted by a picture hat. Serena's fingernails were a greenish-black. Her face was thrown into shadow by the wide-brimmed hat, but it still showed evidence of the vision it had once been. She smiled, and an even row of perfectly white teeth gleamed between two brilliant red lips.
"I am so desperately sorry to have kept you waiting," she purred in a soft, coquettish drawl. "I do hope you will find it in your heart to forgive me, but I regret to say I have simply had no sleep. The dreadful little children from across the square threw a bomb under my bedroom window in the dead of night. My nerves are still unsettled. My life is in constant danger."
"Why, Miss Dawes," said Maggie, "it wasn't them cheering at all. It was only Jim Williams shooting off a cap pistol. You know how he likes to get your goat. And it wasn't no death of night, neither. It was noontime."
"Decent people were still resting," said Serena. "And it was not a toy pistol. You don't understand these things, Maggie. It was a fucking bomb. It nearly tore the goddamn side off the house. I am quite sure my bedroom is structurally unsound as a result. And as for Jim Williams, that no-good, low-rent, middle Georgia redneck, I will fix his wagon. You wait and see." Luther appeared, carrying a Chinese food takeout carton.
"Well, I've got the goldfish ready. Let's go."
Serena insisted on making the circuit of local night spots rather than going directly to the Purple Tree. The effort of getting dressed warranted nothing less than a grand tour, she felt. We went first to the bar of the 1790 restaurant, then to the Pink House, then to the DeSoto Hilton. At each stop, Serena's friends gathered around. She paid attention only to the men among them, flattering and bullying them by turns, and fanning herself with her cocktail napkin.
"Oh, darling, you look so handsome. Dear me, I left my cigarettes in the car. Now be a love and go get them for me. Here, take my keys. God damn, it's hot as a bitch in here. I swear I'll pass out unless somebody turns up the air. Oh, goodness, look at that. My drink's all gone. I simply must have another. Why, thank you. My nerves are still shattered from that bomb attack last night. Haven't you heard? A disappointed lover blew a hole in my bedroom wall. I'm still too upset to talk about it."
As the evening wore on, Luther became concerned that the fluorescence might wear off his goldfish and that they might begin to fade.
"We need to get to the Purple Tree before it's too late," he said.
"We'll get there, darling," Serena trilled, "after we peek in at the Pirate's Cove."
Luther opened the carton and sprinkled a little more fish food into it. After the Pirate's Cove, Serena insisted on a stop at Pinky Masters. Luther added more fish food. At Pinky Masters, several people peered into the carton.
"Goldfish," they said. "So what?"
"Come with us to the Purple Tree," said Luther. "You'll see."
He put another dose of fish food into the carton. When we finally reached the Purple Tree, it was 2:30, and our party of three had grown into a small crowd with Serena at the center of it. Luther was content to look after his goldfish and become quietly drunk. In the black-lit darkness of the purple tree, Serena's face was all but invisible under her hat, except for her teeth, which were all aglow. "If it wasn't a jealous lover," she said, "then it could have been the Mafia. They use explosives too, don't they? They'd give anything to get their hands on the magnificent jewels my late husband left me. He was one of the richest men in the world, as you all know. After the attack last night, I consider myself lucky to be alive." Luther, none too steady on his feet by this time, stepped behind the bar. "Well, here goes," he said, and without further ceremony, he poured the goldfish into the tank. They plunged into the water in a burst of bright green bubbles. Luther held his breath as the bubbles rose and the water cleared. There, swimming around the tank, brighter than the gills or the mouths or the eyes or the fins, were the glowing intestines of his six goldfish, looping, coiled, knotty cores of light at the center of each of his fish. Luther couldn't believe it. Months of work had come to this. Glowing goldfish guts. He had overfed the fish. A silence came over the patrons at the bar.
"Darling," said Serena, "what the hell is that?"
Others were quick to add their two cents. "That's repulsive. It looks like X-ray fish. Yuck." Luther wouldn't be consoled.
"I don't care," he said. "It doesn't matter. I just don't care."
He kept repeating, "I don't care," over and over, in response to any question. "Do you want another drink? What should we do with the goldfish? Are they radioactive?" He gave the same answer. "I don't care." Luther was in no condition to drive, so after we left Serena calling out, "Nighty-night," on her doorstep, I got behind the wheel of his car, drove him home, and deposited him in the living room of his carriage house, the living room that looked out on the dumpster instead of the garden. The night air seemed to revive him a little.
"I don't know why I ever fooled around with goldfish," he said. "I should have stuck to what I know best, insects. It doesn't pay to try to change. I've often thought of changing my life completely, but it never works. I moved to Florida once, but I came back. I've got too much savannah in me, I guess. My family's been here for 7 generations, and after that long a time, I suppose it gets into your genes. It's like the control insects at the laboratory. Did I ever tell you about them? Well, we keep a lot of insect colonies in big glass jars out there. Some of them have been breeding for 25 years. That's 1,000 generations. All they know about life is what goes on inside their jar. They haven't been exposed to pesticides or pollution, so they haven't developed immunities or evolved in any way. They stay the same, generation after generation. If we release them into the outside world, they'd die. I think something like that happens after 7 generations in Savannah. Savannah gets to be the only place you can live. We're like bugs in a jar."
Luther excused himself and asked me to wait in the living room. He walked upstairs unsteadily but with exaggerated care, negotiating the false step without mishap. I could hear him cross the floor overhead. A dresser drawer opened and closed. When he returned, he was carrying a brown bottle with a black screw cap. The bottle was filled with a white powder.
"This is one way out," he said. "Sodium fluoroacetate. It's a poison. 500 times more lethal than arsenic."
Luther held the bottle up to the light. It had a handwritten label that read, "Monsanto, 3039.
"This is the same stuff the Finns dumped down their wells when the Russians invaded in 1939. The water in those wells is still undrinkable. I could kill damn near everybody in Savannah with this bottle. Tens of thousands of people, anyway."
A smile played across Luther's lips as he gazed at the bottle.
"I was in charge of burying a lot of this stuff out on Oatland Island
where we closed down a laboratory years ago. I kept some of it for myself, though. More than enough.
Ever thought of using it? I asked.
Sure. I've always said I'd use it if niggers moved into the house next door. Then niggers did move in next door and made a liar out of me.
Isn't it illegal to have it?
Highly.
Then why do you keep it?
I just like the idea of it.
Luther spoke in a taunting way, like a boy with an extra powerful slingshot.
Every so often I hold it in my hand and think, poof.
Luther handed me the bottle. As I looked at it, I held my breath for fear that the slightest leaking fumes would be lethal. I wondered what went through Luther's mind when he held this bottle and thought, poof. Then I thought I knew. He probably saw the people of Savannah dropping dead one by one. Businessmen sitting on benches in Johnson Square, young revelers carousing on River Street, slow-moving black women holding umbrellas aloft against the hot summer sun, butlers carrying silver trays in the Oglethorpe Club, whores in hot pants on Montgomery Street, tourists lined up in front of Mrs. Wilkes's boarding house. He took the bottle back.
It's an odorless, tasteless poison, he said. It kills without leaving a trace. Just a slight residue of fluoride, but no more than you could attribute to the use of fluoride toothpaste. The victim dies of a heart attack. It's the perfect murder weapon.
Luther went to the front door and opened it. I took this as a sign that the evening was over. But as I stood up, he grabbed hold of the door and pulled it sharply upward. The door lifted completely off its hinges. Luther laid it down flat on the living room floor.
"This is more than just an ordinary door," he said. "It's what's called a cooling board. Cooling boards are for laying out corpses and preparing them for burial. It's a typical feature of old houses. The front door doubles as a cooling board. My family's houses have always had them, so I had one made for myself. When I go, they'll carry me out on this."
Luther sat cross-legged on top of the cooling board door on the living room floor with the bottle of poison in his hand. "Yes," I thought, "and when you go, how many others will you take with you?" Luther closed his eyes. A smile spread across his face.
"You know," I said, "some people in Savannah, or at least some people in Clary's, are afraid you might dump that poison into the water supply someday."
"I know," he said.
"What if I were to grab that bottle out of your hands and run away with it?"
"I'd go back to Oatland Island and dig up some more, probably," said Luther.
Whatever his intentions, Luther clearly relished the speculation about his sinister power.
"When you were a kid," I said, "were you the type who pulled the wings off flies?"
"No," he said, "but I caught June bugs and tied balloons to them."
The next morning at Clary's drugstore, Ruth set Luther's breakfast in front of him. His eggs, his bacon, his Bayer aspirin, and his glass of ammonia and Coca-Cola. Then she went back to the end of the soda fountain and took a drag on her cigarette.
"Ruth," Luther asked, "do you think you can live without glowing goldfish?"
"I can if you can, Luther," she answered.
Luther ate a mouthful of eggs and then some bacon.
He took a swallow of Coke and proceeded to finish his entire breakfast. He had a mournful but peaceful air. Luther ate, he slept, and the demons within him were still. His deadly bottle of poison would remain a harmless curiosity. At least for now.
Chapter 6. The Lady of 6,000 Songs. The stream of people going in and out of Joe Odom's house
seemed to pick up tempo in the weeks after I met him. That might have been because I had joined the flow myself and was now viewing the phenomenon from midstream, so to speak. I often dropped in after breakfast, by which time the aroma of fresh coffee would be gaining the upper hand over the smell of stale cigarettes from the night before. Joe would be clean-shaven and well-rested on 3 or 4 hours' sleep, and among the assorted company, bartenders, socialites, truck drivers, accountants, there would generally be at least one person who had spent the night on the sofa. Currents of activity swirled about the house even at this early hour. People entered and exited rooms, crisscrossing one's field of vision like characters in La Dolce Vita. One morning, Joe sat at the grand piano in the living room, having coffee, playing the piano, and talking to me. A fat man and a girl with braided hair walked through, completely engrossed in their own conversation. "She tore up her mother's car yesterday," the girl said. "I thought it was the TV." "No, the TV was last week." They continued out into the hall, whereupon a bald man in a business suit poked his head in. "The meeting's at 2, he said to Joe. "I'll call you when it's over. Wish me luck." Then he disappeared. At that point, Mandy came in from the kitchen, wrapped in a white sheet and looking like a voluptuous goddess. She plucked a cigarette from the pack in Joe's shirt pocket, kissed him on the forehead, whispered, "Draw up the damn divorce papers," and then skipped back into the kitchen, where Jerry resumed cutting her hair. In the dining room, a young man hooted with laughter as he read Louis Grizzard's column aloud to a white-haired woman who wasn't finding it at all funny. Overhead, the sound of high-heeled shoes clicked across the floor.
"Well, it's 9:30 a.m., said Joe, "and I ain't bored yet."
Joe was talking not just to me, but to a person at the other end of the telephone, which was tucked under his chin. Joe often engaged in split conversations of this sort. Sometimes you knew who the other party was. Sometimes you didn't. "I woke up this morning at 7, he was saying, "and there was this big lump next to me under the covers, which I thought was strange because I had gone to bed alone. Mandy was in Waycross for the night and not due back here for an hour or so. So I lay there just looking at the lump, trying to figure out who or what it was. It was very big, bigger than anybody I knew." "What?" "I was sure it was a human being and not a pile of laundry because it was breathing. Then I noticed something strange about the breathing pattern. It was coming from 2 different parts of the lump. Finally, it dawned on me that the lump was 2 people, which meant I was odd man out, so I yanked the covers back, and sure enough, it was a boy and a girl. I had never seen either one of them before. They were both completely naked." Joe paused for a moment to listen to the person at the other end of the telephone.
"You know me better than that, Cora Bett," he said.
Then, speaking to both of us again, he continued,
"Anyhow, before I had a chance to say anything, the boy asked me, 'Who are you?' Now, I'm pretty sure that's the first time I've ever been asked that question in my own bed. So I said, 'I happen to be the social director here, and I don't believe we've met.' I wasn't sure what to do next, but just then the telephone rang, and I learned that I had a busload of tourists coming at 12:00, 40 people, and that I'd have to make lunch for them because the caterer is sick."
"Yep, lunch for 40.
They're all members of a polka-dancing social club from Cleveland."
Joe smiled as he listened to the voice on the other end.
"Anyhow," he went on, "my 2 newest naked friends got dressed. The boy had tattoos on his arms, a Confederate flag on one arm and a marijuana plant on the other. He put on a really swell T-shirt. It had 'Fuck You' printed on it. At this very moment, both he and the girl are in the kitchen helping make shrimp salad for 40 polka dancers. Jerry's in there, too, cutting Mandy's hair. And that's why I say I ain't bored yet."
Joe said goodbye and hung up the telephone, and as he did, a large blue caftan floated into the room,
The caftan was topped by the round, smiling face of a woman of about 70. She had powder-white skin, set off by bright red lipstick, rouge, and mascara. Her jet-black hair was wound into a huge bun that sat on top of her head like a turban.
"I'm off to Statesboro to play for the Kiwanis Club," she said, waving a set of car keys. "And then I have a beauty pageant in Hinesville at 6. I should be back in Savannah by 9, but in case I'm late, can you get to the bar early and cover for me?"
"Yes, ma'am," said Joe, and with that, the woman floated away in a rustle of silk and a jangle of keys. Joe nodded at the spot where she had been standing. "That," he said, "was one of Georgia's greatest ladies, Emma Kelly. Come with us tonight, and you'll see her in action. Around these parts, she's known as the Lady of 6,000 Songs." For the past 40 years, Emma Kelly had spent the better part of her waking hours driving across the landscape of southern Georgia to play piano wherever she was needed. She played at graduations, weddings, reunions, and church socials. All anyone had to do was ask, and she'd be there. In Waynesboro, Swainsboro, Ellabelle, Hazelhurst, Newington, Jessup, and Jimps. She had played at senior proms for every high school within 100 miles of Savannah. On a given day, she might drive to Metter to play for a ladies' fashion show, then on to Sylvania for a retired teacher's convention, and then to Wren's for a birthday party. Toward evening, she'd usually drive to Savannah to play piano at one of several night spots. But no matter where her engagements took her, she would always be back home in Statesboro, an hour west of Savannah, to play at the Rotary Club lunch on Monday, the Lions on Tuesday, the Kiwanis on Thursday, and the First Baptist Church on Sunday. Emma played old standards and show tunes, blues and waltzes. She was a familiar sight with her flowing caftans and happy coats and that towering turban of black hair held in place by 2 lacquered chopsticks. Emma was descended from the earliest English settlers in Georgia and South Carolina. She had met George Kelly when she was 4 and married him when she was 17. He was a sign painter, and by the time he died, Emma had borne 10 children, not counting 5 miscarriages. As she would always say. Being a devout Baptist, Emma never drank. But once, after playing at the Fort Stewart Officers Club, she was stopped on suspicion of drunk driving. The MP who shined his light through the window told her she had been weaving all over the road for the last 3 miles. That was true, but the fact of the matter was that Emma had been trying to undo her corset and slip out of it at the time. She squinted into the glare of the flashlight, clutching her unfastened clothes about her, and wondering how on earth she was going to step out of the car in this condition and convince the young man she was sober. It was Emma's good fortune that she had played piano at the MP's senior prom years before. He recognized her and knew she never touched a drop, and in a moment, she was on her way. In fact, most of the highway patrolmen knew Emma's car, and when it zoomed past them late at night doing 80 or 90, they generally let it go. Emma had the greatest compassion for the occasional rookie cop who would unknowingly pull her over, siren blaring, blue lights flashing. She'd roll down her window and say softly, "You must be new." She'd be thinking ahead to the browbeating the young man was about to receive from a groggy sheriff. It would go something along the lines of,
"What in blazes you think you doin', boy, draggin' Emma Kelly off the road? Tell you what you gonna do now. You gonna escort this fine lady all the way to Statesboro, see she gets home safe. 1,000,000 pardons, Miss Emma. It won't happen again."
In Savannah, Emma's fans followed her from night spot to night spot like a cheerful caravan, from Whispers to the Pink House, to the Fountain, to the Live Oak Bowling Alley, to the Quality Inn out by the airport. She was good business. Bar receipts always picked up sharply for the duration of her stay and fell off when it was over.
For years, Emma's children had pleaded with her to open up her own piano bar and cut down on the driving. After she killed her ninth deer on the highway, they stopped pleading and just plain insisted.